Time now for New World, a roundtable discussion originating on the campus of the University of Chicago. Our moderator for today, Edward Rosenheim, Jr., Associate Professor of Humanities in the College, University of Chicago. The subject for discussion today is directed toward the future of small business in this country, and will pose the question of whether our economy can continue to support the independent owner and manufacturer. The panel will include distinguished authorities in the fields relating to small business. Monitor goes now to Edward Rosenheim, Jr. at the University of Chicago.
It's important to realize every once in a while that the new world, whose nature and whose problems concern us on these broadcasts, is nowhere more complicated than in its economy. This morning's discussion involves a vital part of the economy in our own country, the part that's constantly, if somewhat loosely, referred to as small business. For a critical look at the present state of American business, I'm joined today by Aaron Director, Professor of Economics in the Law School of the University of Chicago, by Mr. Joseph Wexman, a leading businessman who is president of the Phoenix Finance Company and also a lecturer in business at the University of Chicago, and finally by Mr. Henry Bison, Jr. of Washington, D.C., whose activities as an attorney include the post as counsel for the National Association of Retail Grocers. Mr. Bison, just before we went on the air, you expressed some uneasiness about the use of this term, small business. Isn't it possible to define this term and to use it profitably in an economic discussion of this sort?
I think it is, Mr. Rosenheim. I think it is difficult sometimes to define small business when you're talking about the entire economy. But it is possible if you narrow the scope of what you're talking about. One thing I'd like to mention, though, that I don't think the word small business ought to be used as much as it is. Maybe we ought to find another term.
None of us likes to be referred to as the little man, I suppose. Would you agree that we can talk about something called small business, Mr. Wexman, but that perhaps we ought to take a pretty close look at the use we're going to make of the term?
Well, I agree with Mr. Bison that I don't quite like the term small business, mostly because I always visualize a lot of little short men clustered around a table with their heads barely clearing the top. It's rather difficult a definition, mostly because you can think of small business in so many terms: a size of total assets, size of net worth, the volume of business they do, number of employees, the nature of its problems, how much control it has over its market, or by its position in the industry. I think the latter is probably a fair criterion. And under such circumstances, for example, Studebaker would be a small company as compared with its competition. If you look at number of employees, we have only 8,000 firms that employ 500 people or more, and that is the definition that the government has generally used in connection with its legislation. Actually, 85% of the businesses in this country have three or fewer employees. 70% of the businesses are worth less than $10,000, and only about 13 or 14,000 firms out of over 4 million are worth more than $125,000 net. So what we are really talking about is virtually all of American business except a very tiny segment.
Well, does this eliminate the whole problem that we're supposed to be discussing this morning, Mr. Director?
Well, I don't think we ought to worry much about definition. Every industry in America has a number of firms, and they all differ in size. Now, the real question before us, it seems to me, is whether there's any particular problem attached to the smaller firms in each industry as against the larger firms in each industry.
And that should be a sufficient definition for our purposes, assuming that we can dig up problems that peculiarly face these small businesses. And I take it, Mr. Bison, you feel that there are these problems.
Oh, yes, there are, Mr. Rosenheim. There are several problems. One, of course, is the problem we have today in small business acquiring capital to expand and to modernize their operation. That's a good problem that we're all facing today. Another problem, there are mergers that are going on, antitrust law violations, price discriminations, and other similar problems, too.
Well, are you arguing that so-called small business is suffering because of various of these pressures and difficulties that you've just described?
I think they are. I think they are, and I think it's clear that if they continue as they are now, the situation will become worse.
Well, small business hasn't been becoming worse in the last 15 or 20 years. What's the peculiar about our own time?
Well, our own time is a time when the market is expanding, the population is expanding, and
that makes it a lot easier for small business.
Well, I don't think that, Mr. Director, I don't think that small business is expanding as fast as it should expand in view of the market expansion that's taken place in this country.
Well, Mr. Bison, I generally take the position that small business needs some help, but I would really like to say that small business is doing remarkably well. I think this is actually a golden age for small business. And while there are some difficulties in the marketplace and some problems with finance and some problems with taxation, perhaps, and some problems with marketing, such as you have mentioned, actually these are problems of any change.
To be specific, Mr. Wexman, what are the problems of taxation that confront small business, which gives them a proper complaint? Do they pay more under the corporate tax, say, than the large enterprise pays?
No, they don't.
Well, then what is the complaint?
The complaint is that their fundamental problem is raising money in the initial stages of their business. About 3/4 of all small businesses started with the savings of the individual or his Aunt Susie or Uncle Louie.
Well, all you're suggesting, Mr. Wexman, is there shouldn't be any corporate tax.
No, I'm not. I'm suggesting that at the lower levels, a tax break be given for all business, which will especially benefit small business because it will permit it in its lower earning levels to plow back profits. Of course, you have a problem here that then private individuals can use a corporation as an escape for its own taxes.
It's open to all firms.
I certainly agree with you, Mr. Wexman, because I think the tax laws today are discriminatory against small business. I think, furthermore, that they are leading to monopolistic tendencies, which our antitrust laws are attempting to prohibit. I think, actually, when you come down to think about it, the tax laws and our antitrust laws are in major conflict with each other today.
Well, but let's look at the tax law. It seems to me there is one way in which the tax laws at the present time do contribute to the growth of enterprise. And that's the fact that we have a corporate tax. If we didn't have any corporate tax at all, then it seems to me small business would have no complaint.
Well, Mr. Director, I think you are forgetting one thing. I think that you ought to realize that approximately 85% of small business is not incorporated.
It can be incorporated if it wants to.
Well, it's a question of not only of wanting to, but being able to do it, because you have many state laws today dealing with corporations that are rather rigorous. And it's not a question of forcing small business to become corporations in order to give them what they need and what they really should have.
What should they have, Mr. Bison?
They should have a fair break. They should be able, as Mr. Wexman has said, to be able to plow back into their business more of the earnings, which they've made themselves.
You mean we should exempt them from taxation?
Oh, no, not at all.
Well, how can you give them an advantage if they aren't exempt from the corporate tax?
You can give them an advantage. For instance, I have one proposal that could be made and has been made before Congress today. It's a bill that would allow a small business, or any business as a matter of fact, to deduct from business net income 20% of that business net income if they'll plow it back into their business. The maximum deduction from business net income would be $30,000.
And if a large enterprise wants to plow back 20%, would you give it an exemption too?
Yes, up to the maximum of $30,000.
Well, but then, of course, you're not giving any advantage to anybody.
Yes, you are. You're giving an advantage because the maximum is $30,000, and you're also allowing every businessman who wants to improve his business, to expand his business, to use more of the money for that purpose, which he's now paying Uncle Sam.
I can just see a lot of people flocking into business so that they can get that exemption, and they'll make the competitive problems more difficult if they did that. I think there are some other proposals that should be inspected.
Yeah, I don't think we can spend too much time discussing this tax matter, although it's been very, very interesting to me to see that the rather fundamental difference between you two gentlemen, or between the three of you, really, emerges in your discussion of taxes. I take it that you, Mr. Bison, are not terribly disturbed over the notion that actual legislation can go on the books, plan to relieve and specifically to help the small businessman as opposed to the large one.
Well, I think that it is, and I think it should be, and I think furthermore that We should not cast aside this problem of small business tax relief because you cannot, and we hear from Washington every day, that you cannot have general tax relief this year. I think it's possible to have small business tax relief this year and not to interfere with the fiscal problems of the government.
You're not saying, of course, even though you're stressing the importance of this tax matter, that it's only tax discrimination, so-called, that worries the small businessman, are you?
No.
What are some of the other things? You mentioned mergers, for example.
Well, I've referred to mergers. I'm particularly referring, of course, in the retail food field, where 2,000 stores have been acquired by large operators, large interstate operators in the last 2 years. I think
Mr.
that's
Bison,
a serious problem.
Would you prevent people from making purchases in a free market if they want to buy other stores?
Well, Mr. Director, you talk about a free market. The one way we're going to keep a free market is to keep competitors and to keep competition.
You mean
the one way that's destroyed, of course, is to have mergers going on.
You mean the one way to keep a free market is to destroy it in the beginning by not allowing people to do that which they're supposed to be free to do in a free market?
No, you have to have a free market. In order to have a free market, you must have competitors.
Mr. Wexman, are you prepared to mediate between these two?
You know, I saw a cartoon the other day that said something like, these people are in trouble. This is serious. We should do something about it. Let's write them a letter of sympathy. This matter of finance, which I think was mentioned by Mr. Bison, ties in with something he's saying, and I'd like some information for my own benefit. I've noticed that virtually in every new shopping center, it's generally the largest chain that gets the first crack at the grocery location, for example. Are there any particular problems for the independent in that connection?
Oh, yes, there are, Mr. Wexman, and very serious problems. Independent operators have a great difficulty getting into shopping centers. I'll say that as a general rule. There are exceptions to it. One of the reasons, of course, is that the developers of the property and the financiers of the property require and insist on leases from very large national organizations, and they will not take a lease from an independent operator in some cases, even though the independent operator will pay higher rent. And that, I might say, Mr. Wexman, is one of the most serious problems that we face today.
Well, as I see it, part of the reason is that they want the status of the large operator to attract people without any question to the shopping center. Secondly, the financing of the shopping center may turn on the type of company that has signed leases in the shopping center. And the combination, plus the fact that the independent has much more difficulty raising money, then tends to give the developing communities over to the chain store. Is that your feeling?
That's our feeling.
Well, could I raise a question here as a man who knows very little more about it than the husband who does the shopping for the family on Saturday morning? What about differences in prices between the large chain stores and the independent retailer?
Well,
do they exist?
They exist, but in any competitive area, competition sets the price level. And competition will drive the prices down to the market level, whether it's an independent store or whether it's a chain store. So you will find very little price differences between independent stores and chain stores.
Well, Mr. Bison, there is a tendency to seek relief for small business in legislation, and I have found very little legislation which I would label as good for small business. Now, this matter of prices raises an interesting problem, I think. I see so much publicity in the newspapers in connection with price reductions or price rises. It will say coffee prices went down 3 cents in chain stores. The independents reduced prices 1.5 cents. Per pound. Or if they're fighting minimum markup legislation where the law says you must make at least 7 or 8 or 9% profit on everything you sell, and the independents try to enforce it, the papers are full of headlines, "Independents claim chain store sells too cheap." Now, these are things that I think the independents do and the small business very often does that hurts itself. And if they would just take the attitude that competition is a rather stubborn animal and that they should meet it that way rather than seek refuge in legislation, don't you think that that is the problem, the way to meet the problem?
Well, Mr. Wexman, I think you were referring there in your earlier part of your remarks to the rare exception. I think that most independent store operators today are highly competitive, and I might say I think one of the reasons that we have such a highly competitive food distribution system today is because of the independent operator.
And perhaps also because of the chain store.
And because of the chain store.
What do you mean
store?
By that, Mr. Director?
Well, I would suspect that one of the fields in which competition was least effective was in the older days when there weren't any chain stores, when tradition, custom, location prevented prices from being competitive. And it's precisely since the chain stores have arrived on the field that we've had some real competition in the distribution of ordinary products.
Well, Mr. Director, your statements fly in the face of the facts.
What facts?
The fact is that we've had a competitive distribution system, especially in food, for the entire history of the nation. And it's existed and will continue to exist as long as entry into the distribution system is open, so that any operator, whether he be small or large, can enter into a market and open up a new store and serve the consumers in an efficient manner.
I suppose, Mr. Bison, that that's the reason why the independent grocery stores fought the chain stores so bitterly and tried to impose extra taxes on them, because they were afraid that the chain stores would not provide any competition for them.
Well, there again, Mr. Director, you're making a conclusion, a rather general conclusion, from rather limited experience. I think it's been a rare exception that independents have been fighting chain stores. I don't think that's true today, and I don't think it's been true generally in the past either. I think they like chain stores because it gives them competition, and in most cases they can beat it.
There's a very interesting thing in our history, I think. One of them is that, first of all, the independent invented the supermarket. Secondly, he then favored chain store taxes, which forced the chain stores to adopt the device which the independent had invented, and thereby created his own competitive problem as a result of the legislation which he sought.
Well, I'm rather interested in one thing about your position, Mr. Bison. I'm not quite certain as to whether or not you are crying poor, so to speak, for the independents and for small business. That is the situation you face today an acute one, a dangerous one, or a happy one? Because everything you've suggested so far reveals a rather healthy picture, or so it seems to me.
I think it is, Mr. Rosenheim. I think generally it is a healthy picture. There are several things that I've mentioned before, though, that are on the horizon that can create problems if we don't take care of them right now. I think what we need to do is to prevent the distribution system from becoming monopolized by a few large distributors.
How do we prevent it from becoming monopolized? By giving special privileges to the small businessman?
No, the small businessman, the independent operator, asks for no special privileges.
What does he
ask
for? What does
he asks for a fair opportunity, Mr. Director.
Well, who's stopping him from his fair opportunity?
Well, there are several situations where he's being deprived of that fair opportunity. One is price discriminations, where large buyers in the food field are able to coerce from suppliers special price discrimination.
Well, isn't there legislation on the books now which is supposed to discourage this and, in fact, prevent it?
There is, Mr. Rosenheim, called the Robinson-Patman Act, but it's largely ineffective today. It's not being enforced to the extent that it should be.
I'd like to say, Mr. Rosenheim, that if it's being enforced at all, it's probably interfering with competition. The Robinson-Patman Act was passed, as a matter of fact, to protect existing channels of distribution. And in my opinion, it is not the function of government to determine what prices people should charge for the goods they sell and for the goods they buy.
Well, you've got a nice laissez-faire argument against you, Mr. Bison.
Well, Mr. Director, I'd like to take Mr. Bison's side in part on this. Robinson-Patman legislation, which says, in effect, that you can't charge one buyer any less than the amount of saving that is incurred because he buys in larger quantities. Now, this I would label good legislation if it worked. Unfortunately, a large buyer can contract for the entire output and thus avoid the consequences of the act.
Why shouldn't he get lower prices?
Maybe he should. I'm just pointing out that even this type of legislation, which meets a very dangerous kind of situation, price discrimination, is too easy to avoid. Large buyers, for example, can establish its own facilities and thus increase their integration, which is exactly what transpired. It's very difficult to police Robinson Patman. You can make a minor change in product and take it outside the purview of the statute.
I'm arguing that we shouldn't police it at all, that price discrimination performs a very useful function in the community. There are too many collusive arrangements, and one of the best ways of breaking down a collusive arrangement is for some supplier to offer his product at slightly lower prices on the sly, and in time, of course, the practice spreads and prices are reduced.
Generally, that is done anyhow, but there have been some very bad situations. For example, the tire distribution picture was virtually destroyed by this type of price discrimination, and what happened was that they took the profits they made on the independents and fed it to one of the very large distributors in terms of a price discrimination.
Wonderful. As a result of that, we got lower prices.
No, I don't think we did.
This seems to me to be an argument about fact, among other things, but it's very interesting to me if you take something like this Robinson-Patman Act that you've already referred to, discover you, Mr. Bison, very much for it in principle, although unhappy about the way in which it's worked out in practice. You, of course, Mr. Wexman, a somewhat modified position on this whole thing, but generally believing it's a pretty good idea to attempt. You, of course, Mr. Director, in principle, against the whole notion of the kind of control involved in Robinson-Patman. This, I suppose, is what makes ball games. It certainly makes interesting discussions, even though I have a feeling that we're just hovering on the brink of another entirely different talk. Right now, I think we have to get off the air, so I want to thank Aaron Director of the University of Chicago Law School, Mr. Joseph Wexman, and finally, Mr. Henry Bison, Jr., and say that this is Edward Rosenheim, Jr., returning you to Monitor in Radio Central.
Thank you, Edward Rosenheim, Jr., Associate Professor of Humanities in the College, University of Chicago, for moderating our roundtable discussion today on the subject of the future of small business in this country, a provocative commentary on conditions surrounding the small businessman of today, and our thanks to your colleagues, your distinguished colleagues, for their part in the roundtable discussion. We should be looking forward to next week's edition of New World, the subject, a transatlantic round table panel between New York and London with noted men of authority and law discussing criminal trials in the United States and England. That'll be on the Monitor Beacon. Take one.